claimed the lives of 14 Palestinians with fierce winds and flooding, leaving 1.5 million displaced Gazans in danger. The United Nations has slammed Israel for blocking the much-needed supplies for the Palestinians living in makeshift tents as a political choice. Let us now cross over to Deir al-Balah and get an update from Ghad Ibrahim on the ground. Ghad, what are the latest developments?
Yes, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have suffered who survived another wet and flooding night following the rainfall, the heavy rainfall that flooded all many areas across the Gaza Strip following the Byron storm that have already been long warned about. And the civil defense workers and the Gaza media office have been already sounding the alarm about. So the situation on the ground is really very disastrous and catastrophic for hundreds of thousands of families who are now totally exposed because of the damage of their tents encampments across the Gaza Strip. And according to Gaza Media Office, 90% of the tents here in the Gaza Strip have been completely soaked and damaged by the heavy rainfall that started 3 days ago and is continuous in many areas across the Gaza Strip until this moment. So it is very disastrous for many of the families, and it is very fatal actually. Since the Byron storm started until this moment, we are talking about at least 14 Palestinians killed as a result of the storm or as a result of being completely exposed to the bad weather conditions. 3 children actually died because of hypothermia. The last was Hadil Hamdan, a 9-year-old girl who succumbed to the severe cold in the southern parts of Khan Yunis city. Previous to this, another Palestinian child, Rahab Abu Jazza, the 8-month-old child, also succumbed to cold and hypothermia, and she was announced dead at Nasser Complex lately yesterday. Amidst this, another catastrophe is unfolding across the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian civil defense has been receiving distress calls from across the Gaza Strip about many residential buildings collapsing on the heads of their residents, killing at least 13 Palestinians. The last of these collapses was in a Sheikh Ridwan neighborhood, in which a family home or a home belonging to Nassar family collapsed on the heads of its residents, killed at least 2 of the same family and injured many. And the search is still underway for another missing man under the rubble of the same collapsed building. So this is very repetitive, and this has been happening since the beginning of the storm until this moment, and it is causing many fears among the Palestinians, as the storm does not only and not directly affect those displaced in the tents only, but also many or hundreds of families, those who are still in the partially bombed or the partially damaged houses across the Gaza Strip.
Thank you so much, Ghad, for the update. Ghad Ibrahim joining us from Deir al-Balah. The Israeli occupation forces and armed settlers have intensified their attacks against Palestinians across the occupied West Bank, resulting in injuries and widespread destruction. Palestinian sources have said Israeli forces raided Tubas, Bethlehem, Ramallah and Aria, vandalizing homes, shops and other property. In Shukba, west of Ramallah, a young Palestinian was wounded after the Israeli forces stormed the village, firing live rounds and tear gas. Confrontations were reported also between the Israeli forces and Palestinians in Tamun, Tuku, Al-Mughayr, Silmad and Akabat Jaber camp. Since the Israeli genocide in Gaza began in 2023, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed and over 20,000 others abducted in the West Bank. Earlier we were joined by our West Bank correspondent Nick Ahmed for an update on the latest Israeli atrocities across the occupied territory. Let us take a listen.
Let me start from the village of Al-Mughayr to the northeast of occupied Ramallah, where the famous family of Abu Hammam, whom we have been covering their story now for almost 2 years, they have been clinging on to their land, staying put, do not move, and do not subdue to the Israeli settlers' attacks. Now this family stands alone in front of the settlers and in front of the Israeli forces, because the area is considered to be a closed military zone. No one can reach towards that family, no matter what the settler do to that family, no ambulance, no support, no media can even reach towards that family in the southern villages of Nablus, speaking of Aqraba, precisely in the area of Jabal Kartafa. This area has been also subjected to similar stories. The Palestinians over there are trying to save that area in front of the continuous settler attacks. Also in Beta, to the south of Nablus, the same situation. The Israeli settlers have attacked the Palestinians over there. The Israeli forces called them to Al-An'ari, a refugee camp, and into Qalandia, a refugee camp south of Ramallah, north of occupied Al-Quds, and attacked many villages in the province of Ramallah, like Hania Brud and Bitin to the east of Ramallah. Let us go towards the north a little bit, where the Israeli forces have attacked Tammun to the south of Tubat.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that Israel's decision to legalize 19 new settlements in the occupied West Bank marks a dangerous escalation. The legalization of the 19 settlements was announced by the Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich. Hamas condemned the move as part of a wider project of annexation and Judaization of occupied territories. In a press statement, Hamas said the move reflects the extremist nature of the Israeli regime, which treats Palestinian land as colonial spoils. The movement stressed that settlement expansion violates international law and UN resolutions, warning it aims to isolate Palestinian towns and villages and push communities towards displacement. Hamas urged the international community, the United Nations, and human rights organizations to take responsibility and act to stop settlement growth and hold the Israeli leaders accountable. Clashes between Thailand and Cambodian forces continue despite claims by U.S. President that the two sides have agreed to halt hostilities. Trump has said that the two Southeast Asian neighbors would cease all shooting on Friday and return to a peace deal signed in October. Cambodia, however, reported fresh Thai airstrikes on Saturday, accusing Thailand of using F-16 jets to drop bombs. Thailand's prime minister says a ceasefire would only be possible once Cambodia withdraws all its troops and removes the landmines it has planted. At least 21 people have been killed and hundreds more wounded in 6 days of clashes. Around 700,000 people have also been displaced along the border. The conflict centers on disputed ownership of centuries-old temples. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer who earlier joined us from Bali, Indonesia. He believes the interference of external actors in the conflict between Thailand and Cambodia would only worsen the situation.
Certainly, neither side is being completely honest, and it's kind of odd, really, that there still are no observers on the ground, because what we have is sort of conflicting allegations always about who fired first, and I'm inclined
right.
to believe the Cambodians myself. But the idea that Trump can just make a few phone calls and make it all go around shows how delusional he is. Just out to fill in his bingo card so he can claim having stopped another war. It's simply not going to happen. In fact, the current leadership of Thailand made that perfectly clear, that they're not really willing to discuss a ceasefire, and the terms they've set for discussing a ceasefire are far less than clear. And I think the best thing that can happen really is for the international community to stay out of it. Typically, it's those foreign imposed solutions that aggravate the situation. This whole thing arises from the colonial period and actions
right.
that were taken by colonial rulers. And there's no reason for them to get involved again when I think the Thais and the Cambodians are ultimately perfectly capable of dealing with this on their own.
The admiral in charge of U.S. forces in the Latin America and Caribbean, who has been critical of U.S. strikes on alleged rock boats in the region, has retired 2 years ahead of schedule. Admiral Alvin Halsey has reportedly had disagreements with U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth over operation in the region. He had earlier voiced concerns about the legality of the U.S. military's lethal strikes against alleged drug trafficking boats. Since September, the U.S. has deployed more than 15,000 troops warships and fighter jets in the Caribbean under the pretext of fighting drug traffickers. Venezuela, however, says the military buildup is aimed at toppling the Venezuelan government to gain control of its oil resources. The strikes on boats have killed at least 87 people so far. The U.S. Congress is now scrutinizing the boat attacks, including one that killed two survivors clinging to the wreckage of an earlier strike. Let us now talk to Greg Simons, Associate Professor of Uppsala University, joining us from Istanbul now. Very good to have you on the program, Mr. Simons. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this situation. What strategic or political factors do you believe within the U.S. Southern Command and the Trump administration influence Admiral Holtz's decision to retire early?
Well, I think oddly that it demonstrates that there are still some high-ranking officers within the U.S. military that have some kind of moral or ethical compass, because he obviously saw that this was contradictory, it's an illegal order. Not only is it violating international law, it's violating humanitarian law, and it was not something that could sit with his conscience. And of course, when you have someone as psychopathic as Hegseth in charge, who was a much lower ranking officer than Halsey, who is just a war hawk and believes that somehow this is going to be a cakewalk. They go in with the justification and pretext of narco-terrorism, steal the oil. I mean, it's as clear as day. And there are some people in the U.S. military that still stand for ethics and principles, which is a good sign, I suppose, even if those in political control absolutely have nothing like this.
Now, Professor Simons, how do you believe his departure is going to now affect U.S. military operations and partnerships in Latin America and the Caribbean, especially amid scrutiny of recent boat strikes?
I think this removes obstacles for their warmongering and so forth because, yeah, I mean, he was obviously some person who would not bow to political pressure and was felt compelled to resign. And, of course, there'll be those in Latin America watching this. They don't want to be objects of U.S. Imperialism and usury of their resources. I mean, you got a big sea change in Latin America. I mean, you got a socialist president in Colombia. I mean, what would happen is that if Trump is stupid and arrogant enough to believe that he will get away with it, this will unite Latin America like nothing before. This will be like what Iraq, the U.S. Unprovoked and illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq did to the Middle East. This is going to do to Latin America.
Pleasure to talk to you, Professor Simons. Greg Simons, Associate Professor of Uppsala University, joining us from Istanbul. Hundreds of people have held a protest in the Canadian city of Montreal against the cancellation of a program which guarantees citizenship for skilled migrants. Demonstrators gathered outside the Immigration Ministry's office, holding placards and banners calling for the return of the PEQ program. Some protesters say the cancellation of the program will put the lives of thousands of immigrants in jeopardy. The PEQ was an immigration program that allowed temporary workers to apply for permanent residency. The government says the program had certain flaws and will be replaced with a more rigorous process aimed at curbing illegal migration. And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله هست مهم رو کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. You are listening to the Spring of Truth, and I'm Muhammad Liaquat Abbas, your host, and I'm going to present you a beautiful and a very powerful quote from Imam Khomeini. The Imam says, if you are only after learning, and this learning does not accompany a correct nurturing and the purification of one's soul, it is only storage of knowledge. We see the Holy Quran also saying a similar word, that is in Surah Al-Jumu'ah, Surah number 62, Ayah number 5, the example of those who were entrusted with the Torah and then failed to uphold it is like that of a donkey carrying volumes of knowledge. So it is understood and pretty much understood that if you are only learning and learning is not helping you in nurturing, it means that you are only a storage of knowledge. The knowledge is of no use for you. The knowledge is of no use for your society. It is only for yourself, just for yourself, without any use. It's as if like you have a big library with a lot of books, but those books are useless for you. Why? Because you are not referring to them. You are not going through them, what the books are saying. So over here, we have another hadith where the Imam says, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, knowledge is accompanied by action. So whoever knows acts. So Imam Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam has a similar hadith where the Imam says, belief is accompanied with action. In order for you to act upon your belief, you should have knowledge. But there are people who have knowledge but do not act upon it. So consider yourself, if you are only learning, if you're only after learning, then brothers and sisters, don't be only after learning. And the knowledge which doesn't have purification of one's soul is a useless knowledge. So we have a beautiful dua, which is, wal ilm la yanfa, the knowledge which has no use. There might be knowledge which is of no use. So we don't want the knowledge which is of no use. We want only that knowledge which we can keep to our disposal. Let me relate to you, in our life, a doctor who smokes and never exercises has vast medical knowledge but lacks self-purification. Their knowledge is stored file, not a lived reality, making them a hypocrite in their field. So brothers and sisters, if I want to wind up, knowledge without self-reformation is a burden and not a light. It's like owning a library, just like I've said, which fills the space and does not enlighten the soul. True knowledge transforms your character. Otherwise, it is worthless.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
A Spring of Truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Never forget to say, was an IRIB English radio program.
Welcome back to The Voice of War. My guest today is Professor Ilan Pape, one of the most prominent and provocative historians of the modern Middle East. He is the director of the European Center for Palestinian Studies at the University of Exeter and is best known for his groundbreaking work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including his books The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and Lobbying for Zionism. His latest book, Israel on the Brink, offers a sobering diagnosis of what he sees as seven internal cracks threatening the future of the Israeli state, while also tracing the deeper historical, ideological, and geopolitical forces that have shaped its path. Ilan, thank you very much for joining me on The Voices of War.
It's a great pleasure to be on The Voice of War in the program. Thank you very much for having me. Great.
It's been a long time coming, so I'm very grateful that we finally be able to lock it in. Maybe we can start straight away with the with your most recent book, Israel on the Brink. In it, you open up by saying Israel's demise is inevitable, not because you're a determinist, but because the process is already in motion. So what signs of this internal unraveling do you see most clearly?
Yeah, I think each process that I identify in the book by itself is not powerful enough either to bring a regime change or disintegration or a fall. I mean, I'm not a prophet, so I don't know exactly what will happen, but I do feel that the structure that is the state and the ideological project is collapsing. Very important one is the internal implosion from or the implosion from within the Israeli Jewish society, and this goes to one of the two basic challenges Zionism had. One, and we'll talk about it a bit later, is the challenge of imposing a European state on the Arab world at the expense of a local indigenous Palestinian people. But the other challenge, and that's what is really part of the internal implosion is all about in Israel, is the challenge of defining a religion as nationalism, defining Judaism as nationalism and not as religion. And it took time, and now it's very clear that this is not an intellectual debate. What does it mean to be a Jewish state? What does it mean to be a Jew in Israel? It became a struggle for life and death between those who thought that Judaism can be equated with pluralism, liberal practices, democracy, and so on, be that as it may, only for the Jews, not for the Palestinians, or those who say, no, if it's a Jewish state, then it's a theocracy, then it is a messianic state, then it is loyal to everything that they read in the Bible, everything that they read in the sacred writings or books that were published after the Bible, kind of what we call the halakha in Jewish, the halakha is like the Sharia, it's the kind of the law, the Jewish law state. And as I said, this is not academic. That means that it defines the public space, it defines the laws of the land. It also defines the attitude towards the Palestinians, and not only the Palestinians, but also to the neighboring Arab state, because this particular version that has been developed and now is tearing the Jewish society apart from within is also messianic. So they believe that they have an historical opportunity to rebuild probably a kingdom that never existed, because it's all a fable, the kingdom of Solomon and David. But they want to recreate it, and it extends even beyond Palestine. So that's one very powerful process. As I say, not by itself leading to collapse, but with the other, it's very powerful. Mm. And there is a dynamic here, because this is the trajectory because this is the orientation of the Israeli Jewish society, it increases the isolation of Israel in the world. Israel is losing its traditional allies. Now it's very clear that the civil society regards Israel as a pariah state, but it will, I believe, eventually affect governments and political elites, and even economic elites, not for moral reasons, but because it would not be a very good place to invest money. So you have the isolation from the outside. You also have a Palestinian society that, yes, right now is led by a very fragmented, disunited, and not a very capable political elite, but it's a very young society. And as I show in the book, the younger generation is far more united, assertive, knowledgeable, and I do believe it will have its say in the future, and it would not use the same kind of diplomacy and tactics as the present political elite. It would be much more devoted, I think, to liberation and decolonization, and would ask the world to support that kind of Palestinian position. So with the other two processes I described, this may be more possible. It's not possible now to enlist the world, let's say, the world's support for the idea of a one state or the decolonized Palestine. But if the two other processes that I'm describing would indeed develop, then it is possible. This also goes along with a very deep economic crisis. Israel is now preparing itself for decades of war economy. War economies can survive 3, 4, 5 years. They cannot survive a decade. So I foresee a very deep economic crisis as well that would depend very much on the American taxpayer. And I don't think either Republicans or Democrats in the distant future would continue to be so generous with the money of the American taxpayer. To that I would add, and with this I would finish, and just to give a bit of a display here, the disassociation of Jews, especially young Jews, from the idea of Zionism in Israel. Israel is losing the younger Jewish generation, especially in the United States. And without that kind of support, you remain depending on material interests and not, moral interests. And I don't know how long can a regime rely only on material, economic, and military interests to sustain a state for a very long time. It's not a matter that the state disappears, states don't disappear, but to keep the people that you need to maintain a state in a war economy, isolation, a pariah state, where the Jews in the world do not support you, would be very, very difficult in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to pivot back to that first point, and that's the internal fractures that you've described inside Israel itself. I mean, what we see in the West, and you know this far better than I do, is that we get the impression that the society is cohesive as a whole, and its popular support for the Gaza war in particular, and also for what's happening in the West Bank. And you also draw the distinction in the book between the state of Judea and the state of Israel. So can you just give us a little more insight into what you mean by this internal fracture, and how much that actually has, how much of a chance that actually have, to bring about some change in the Israeli government?
Yeah. So we have to look at it the other way around, in a way. The idea in Israel was that whatever are the internal dissent or disagreements, there is a common enemy. And at the time that you face the common enemy, all the disagreements are forgotten and we're all united. Now, this may be true for the short wars that Israel had, 6 days war, 3 weeks war in 1973. No, this cannot, when we see it's happening, folding in front of our eyes, this kind of unity cannot be held for 2 years. So, to begin with, yes, there was a total support for everyone in the Jewish society for the Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip as a reaction to the 7th of October 2023 Hamas attack. But then all the dissent and conflict, the internal conflict that preceded the 7th of October, by which you had two entities, and I will describe them in a minute, fighting for the whole everything that the state can offer in terms of institutions and powers, that internal conflict reappeared about 6 or 7 months into the war. So for half a year, you had a sense of a cohesion. And it affected, the dissent affected every aspect. Maybe this is not reported enough in the world, but even on the issue of the hostages, certain camps, which I call the state of Judea, and I'll explain in a minute what I mean by that, the state of Judea was not that concerned about the fate of the hostages because they belong to the other camp, the liberal, secular camp. So they showed no much compassion for them.
These are people from the kibbutzim, etc., right?
Yeah, exactly. People who also gathered to be the left of Israel.
Mm.
They're the ones who mostly were either killed or abducted. And they were attacked, the families were attacked as traitors and undermining the military effort. So the cohesion isn't there anymore. It wasn't there. The war or the genocide or the operation, call it what you want, cannot gloss over the kind of division that occurred, I would say, at the beginning of this century, between what I call the state of Judea, that is a group, an ideological movement that grew in the Jewish settlements in the West Bank and gained more and more support among the less well-off sections of the Israeli society, mainly people from originally from North African Jewish origin, and from Orthodox and traditional Jewish people, creating this vision of a state that is run by religious law, that does not need democracy, nor does it have any inhibitions in dealing with the Palestinians and even with the Arab neighbors, recreating this ancient kingdom that everybody would respect and fear, not only in Palestine, but all over the Arab world. And luckily, there are these populist allies like Trump, populist fascist leaders in Europe, Modi in India, and so on. So they didn't even feel that they were isolated internationally, not to mention that some of the Arab rulers were very willing to go along with this kind of a vision of a future. The state of Israel is the old state, the one that tried unsuccessfully, one state, but it's tried to reconcile universal values as democracy, socialism, and liberalism with the idea of a racist ethnic state. They didn't succeed, but at least they attempted. And they created at least a democracy for the Jews in Israel, if not for the Palestinians in it. And they were already losing the battle before the 7th of October 2020. And the events of the 7th of October and after that do not help the chances of success. In fact, it led to a huge immigration. We don't know the numbers. Hundreds of thousands of what I call the State of Israel residents, if you want, with their money, because they have dual nationality, because they have jobs that they can ignite elsewhere. So all of it creates not only a kind of a cold civil war, it creates a vacuum in the elite. And in fact, the only bastion remaining that the state of Judea hasn't taken over is the judicial system. But they are doing their best now to complete the mission there as well.
Which is why we saw protests over the past several, certainly even before October 7th, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the kind of secular state of Israel, so to speak, realized that this is the last battle. I mean, if they take over the judicial system, not much is left for the others.
How did Israel get to this point? I mean, we often hear it described as the most far-right government. Of course, Netanyahu's been around for, you know, three decades in one form or another. How did Israel get to this point?
Well, I think the problem was that what the old Israel offered was impossible. You cannot square the circle. You cannot really create a state that is both Jewish and democratic. Because the only definition that they had of Judaism was an ethnic definition, which meant that the ethnicity of the state did not respect or did not represent, first of all, 20% of the people who were not Jewish. Secondly, did not represent the millions of people that Israel kicked out of Palestine in 1948, and did not resolve the issue that was at the very heart of Zionism, namely the imposition of a European Jewish state on the heart of the Arab world at the expense of the Palestinians. So all these attempts, eventually by the Israeli Jewish electorate, were seen as not leading to any kind of resolution. Israel needed to continue and police by force millions of Palestinians, a situation that not so dramatically as it happened in the last 2 years, but incrementally eroded the legitimacy of the state, eroded the support among Jews and Arabs to the idea of Israel. The international community began to, you know, to pay attention in the 1990s, and ever since then, to the constant violation of human rights and civil rights by Israel. So there was no dividend from this game, and I think there was an exhaustion in the Jewish society. You cheat yourself, you cheat the world, and eventually it doesn't really work. So I think that's one major reason for that. The second reason is, of course, the cycle of violence, because once you violently invade the country and there is a reaction, the reaction is not always non-violent, it's violent as well. And this cycle, that once the resistance to your wish to dispossess the people is an armed struggle or a guerrilla warfare, the reaction of the state is even more severe and violent, and in turn that creates another more vicious, if you want, of bloodshed and violence. So it's easy to convince the population that this is life. There's no other option. The only option is to kill, to want, to fight, to genocide, and so on. Unfortunately, we didn't have the right people who would show the courage and lead a different kind of a movement, who say, well, the conclusion from that reality is that the idea of a Jewish state is the problem here. And there are alternatives which are more humane, that most people in the world cherish in their own countries, which is a democratic, a purely democratic country, and not an ethnic racist country. But that, when that choice had to be made between, are you willing to be a real democracy, or do you want to be actually an apartheid racist? Unfortunately, most of the Jews voted in one way or another for the latter option, because the first option means giving up all the privileges, the land, the resources, everything you robbed from the indigenous people, and you don't want to give it back unless you are forced to do so.
Yeah, and forcing it has been a big challenge, which I think brings me to the next point. And you rightly identified that, of course, the global opinion of Israel is rapidly shifting. And you dedicate in the Israel lobby several chapters to explaining how the pro-Israel advocacy networks, or AIPAC in short, especially in the US and UK, have shaped public discourse and foreign policy. So can you tell us about those networks and what impact they've actually had on US in particular, but of course UK as well, as foreign policy?
Yes. First of all, we have to appreciate the longevity of this effort. It starts very early on, and around 1900 becomes already quite an impressive...
That's how thick the book is, to dive into it.
So it's more than a century of advocacy, and one should not underestimate the importance of experience. If you exist for such a long time, of course, as the year passed by, you are much more experienced, and you already have an aura of a very powerful organization that you better not deal with. You do what they want, even if they don't approach you directly or threaten you directly. So I think it's important to understand that from the very beginning, I think, Zionist ideologues and leaders understood that there was a moral issue. There was a moral problem, with the idea that the only solution for the European racism towards Jews was to impose the Jewish state on the Arab world the extent of the Palestinians. They understood that this was something that in a world that began to talk about decolonization, a world especially after the first Second World War, talked about human rights, and the Human Rights Declaration of 1948 created the United Nations that wanted to protect people from further oppression, a world that wanted to prevent a Third World War given the horrific consequences of the two first, well, the First and Second World War. In that world, however you presented the Zionist project, it was a project of dispossession and elimination of the native people. Even when good intentions were proud of it, as long as you were loyal to the idea that this has to be a Jewish state, there was no way of respecting the new universal code, moral code that the world, especially the West, pretended to adopt. It adopted it in a very exceptional, hypocritical way, but that's another story. In any case, so the advocacy had to take into account, I think from very, very early on, and I show it in the book, that they have very little chance of winning the moral debate. That if you want, the facts were on the side of the Palestinians. The truth was on the side of the Palestinians. So what do? You need an advocacy that is much more a structure of coercion, maybe temptation, sometimes pressure, in order to make sure that the people with power would see it in their interest to support you. Maybe some of them would be convinced morally, you know, ideologically, that what you do is fine. And I think at the beginning it was a bit easier for the lobby, because you could convince American white settlers that white Jewish settlers have the right to settle someone else's, colonize someone else's homeland, also Australian. They could be easily convinced by that. All three settler colonial projects definitely supported each other morally, despite the injustice that was the integral part of their project. You could convince Christian Zionists that this is a project that would lead to the resurrection of the dead, the return of Jesus, and so on. And then also convince the West that this is a Western democracy in a sea of Arab and Islamic barbarism. The problem was for the lobby that as we move from 48 and we reach 1967, and the occupation is far more transparent and exposed to everyone to see and understand, it's much more difficult to build a moral justification for the daily oppression of the Palestinians. And that's when the lobby begins to use the tactics of, as I said, inducement and coercion. And it's very effective. It knows how to do it. It accompanies politicians in Britain and in the United States from very early stages in their careers, so that they would be committed to the cause when they begin their political career, and then you can ask for the dividends or for the payback later on if they reach a more powerful position. You destroy politicians if they dare to challenge the lobby. You use money, power, clout, political clout. And of course, as I said before, the cycle of violence, the way the Palestinian resistance developed, objectively here and there, helped the lobby to say, you see, see who we're dealing with.
We're dealing with terrorists. Yeah.
The terrorists, exactly. 9/11 was the point that everybody thought this would be the most successful moment of the lobby, that they would associate 9/11 with Palestine. They did take into account that already in 2001, in 9/11, the civil society, even in the United States, were far more knowledgeable, far more sophisticated, and understood very well that you cannot compare the Palestinian resistance and anti-colonialist struggle for freedom and liberation with the act of terrorism committed by Al-Qaeda on the American soil. And that is something the lobby doesn't know how to deal with ever since. Yeah.
As in the civil society piece.
Yeah, the civil society, the fact that the internet allows far more information and knowledge. The Z generation, Generation Z, and even the one before it, are curious people, are alert to fake news, to fabrication. We call them naive, but they do understand who is a victim and who is a victimizer. We saw it in the demonstration in the US and elsewhere, in Italy in particular, for instance. They are not mesmerized by the main shield of immunity Israel provides, which is to say it's a very complicated and only we a complicated issue, and we are the only ones who really understand it, and you have to listen to our and they don't buy it anymore, and the lobby doesn't know what to do with this, you know.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
The following is part of a speech delivered on April 27, 2017 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the participants of the 34th International Quran Competitions.
At
to say here is that we have certain concepts in the Quran which really build a powerful and glorious life for the Islamic Ummah. They are really a source of liberation from difficulties for the Islamic Ummah. We have such concepts in the Quran. In order to implement these concepts, we should primarily instill them into Muslims' minds in Islamic societies. We should act in a way that these concepts become transparent for the Islamic community, so much so that nothing can stop them from moving forward. We have serious problems at this stage. We should do something to turn these concepts into well-established norms and common thoughts among all the masses of the people in the Islamic Ummah. This is a task that should be carried out in the area of the Quran. All these meetings, gatherings, recitations, and efforts to memorize the Quran, all of which are necessary and good, are an introduction to that public understanding.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to mention one of these concepts as an example. God says, "Whoever rejects evil and believes in Allah has grasped the most trustworthy handhold that never breaks." The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 256. This is a concept. This is a principle. Rejecting evil and believing in God is a principle. We have divided the whole world into two zones. One is the area where evil exerts its influence, which should be rejected by us, and another zone, which is the area where God exerts his influence. We should believe in this zone. This is faith-based identity versus evil-based identity. Of course, this does not mean that we should constantly fight against everyone who believes in evil-based identity. It does not mean that we should kill them, that we should disconnect ourselves from them, and we should stop exchanging knowledge and information with them. Rather, it means that our faith-based identity should be independent and have clear boundaries so that we can protect ourselves, achieve perfection, and move forward in the face of evil-based identity.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. From Tehran, a warm greetings to each and every one of you, dear listeners. Welcome to Iran Radio, your daily source of inspiration and reflection. Broadcasting from the heart of Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Together, we'll explore moments of faith, seek knowledge, and share stories that bridge hearts across the distances. So whenever you are at home, on the road, or taking a quiet moment, stay with us. A rich tapestry of voices, insights, and culture awaits you. First up, we have today's special. This daily program is a vibrant fusion of faith and culture, exploring various Islamic and Iranian occasions. Get ready for a right tapestry of Quranic verses, heartfelt prayers, inspiring nasheeds, insightful reports, and so much more. Then get ready to listen to the hadith of the day. Sheikh Muhammad Jafar Danish shares a profound hadith from the Holy Prophet and his revered family, Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. You'll get a brief explanation and commentary, often trying into significant dates on your lunar or solar calendars. It's a moment of reflection you'll carry with you throughout the day. Next, tune in for another captivating segment from our very own Iran Radio's productions. Following that, it's time for Let's Recite the Quran. This program draws you closer to the Holy Book, guiding you through eloquent recitation at level 2. We're explore Tajweed.